Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Roast Extra. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Sunday the 28th of July. The summer holidays are in full swing. I think we did say, didn't we, that the roast was taking a break, and it kind of is, but this is The Roast Extra, where we've got three interviews with companies who've had recent updates, and I guess we just had to talk about them, didn't we, Kev?
Yeah, I mean, that was the deal. We said we weren't going to do any more during the summer, but when Oliver's grant landed and Sepan had some news, and then Priority AI had some big news as well, then we thought, right, we'll just stick them all together and you can all have a listen on Sunday again, so...
Yeah. So what have you been up to thus far into the holidays or summer start? I know you were in the UK last week.
Holidays? What's that? I've been working my butt off for the last however many weeks. No, I've just been working. I was in the UK. We went to visit a couple of companies that are not listed. What else? We met with Oliver in London. I met with Sepan in Birmingham, went to Callum Somerton's wedding, which was a good experience, in Lincoln Cathedral, and then Salisbury Cathedral, sorry, and a beautiful reception. Yeah, and we ate a lot of food, and then we came back, or I came back. That was it.
Very good.
And I've been working all this week. I think I'm going to do exactly what you're going to do next Wednesday.
Downtime. Yeah,
I'm going to call it a day for. Maybe a week, and
yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. I said I'm the digital detox, literally going to go down to Devon and stay by the coast for like 4 or 5 nights and literally just turn everything off and just do coastal walks, spend some time with the family. I'm going to take the dog down there and just literally walk and just be, do you know what I mean, and just switch off from it all, because sometimes I think you have to do that, right? Digital detox.
Yeah, you definitely do. You have to get away from what we normally have as a life, so.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, without further ado, I'll let you intro the first company.
So we'd like to welcome our first guest on this week's Sunday Roast, which is Oliver Friesen from Guardian Metal Resources. This week, they came out with a grant and a huge raise. So now they have $21.2 million to spend. So I'm going to pass it over to you, Charles, to see where this money's going to go.
Thanks, Kev. Oliver, hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, Charles. Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, doing well. A bit tired, a bit exhausted, or has it just got started?
I'm pretty tired. You know, truth be told, it's been a very busy couple of weeks. But obviously, the outcome that that we were able to announce is a very important one and a huge day for the company. I'll probably recharge the batteries this weekend. And then, you know, with the coffers topped up there and obviously the award from the Department of Defense, we're just getting started here. This kind of feels like the starting gun for Guardian. It really does. Everything we've done up till now is the building blocks to get to this point. And now the fun part begins. So Monday onwards, it's going to be a lot of work, but it's going to be really exciting and rewarding, I think.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it has been rewarding for shareholders as well, if we look at the share price action. I mean, when we first started talking, before anyone really had heard about Guardian, formerly Golden Metal, and I was saying, oh, China's going to do tungsten export bans and export controls, and the US is going to have to start stockpiling their own metal, so they're going to have to do grant funding. And a couple of years ago, it sounded like crazy conspiracy talk.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're there, right?
Yeah.
And it must feel like, for me personally, but I must be for you as well, as a leader of a company, it must feel very rewarding, maybe is the right word, for that conviction that you've had over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is rewarding. I think it's an industry where you don't often get these things right. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a lot of companies who pick up good assets just at the wrong time in the cycle. And, you know, timing is everything really in this kind of crazy world that we work and invest in. Mm-hmm. Crazy world being mining, of course. But, you know, once in a while, it all comes together and you actually get it right. And it, you know, this typically happens maybe once or twice in your career. So yeah, I mean, it is quite rewarding. You know, I remember 4 years ago trying to get people to care about tungsten. And then 2 years ago at the IPO, trying to get people to care, and very few people cared. And now it's the complete opposite, where I'm getting, you know, some people that I never thought I'd hear from reaching out to me and saying, hey, you know, this is a pretty special company and position you're in. We need to move this forward. So yeah, it's pretty rewarding, but the real reward will be, know, when we can deliver a mine tungsten concentrate to the US market. And I also just want to quickly start off there, Charles, as well, and extend a huge thanks to, you know, on behalf of our Golden Metal Resources team, which is our US operating company, as well as the global Guardian Metal Resources team, a thanks to obviously the United States Department of Defense and the Trump administration for making, you know, the award happen, which is obviously really important when it comes to, you know, reshoring and bringing back mines, tungsten supply chains onto US soil.
Yeah, well, I think this is the thing, isn't it? Because tungsten pricing a couple of years ago was, you know, kind of a little bit lower, but it's going higher and higher almost every day is what it feels like. Antimony is obviously leading the charge, but that got the export controls before the tungsten did. So you assume tungsten is just going to keep going higher and higher. And obviously the margins that you're going to get when you eventually release the PFS, they're going to be crazy, right, compared to what you maybe had a couple of years ago as estimates.
Yeah, I mean, every uptick in price is a higher price that we can plug into our model. And you pointed it out, antimony is up, I think it's 6x now. So it's gone
something. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because all of the, again, this is stuff we've been talking about for years now. People suddenly switch onto it, that the stockpiles that the US had of defense metals, they sold them all off at bottom dollar. And now they're having to buy them all back at top dollar, the opposite of what you want to do as any investor. But, you know, here we are. I mean, you're in the perfect kind of spot. And I guess the question is now, obviously, $6.2 million in grant funding. Potentially, the money is not that important so much as the backing of the DoD, you know, compared to the market cap that we have now. And I guess the question is, you're going to, you know, put this towards a pre-feasibility study for Pilot Mountain. Can you kind of speculate on what kind of numbers you might have? Improvements on the scoping study that was done back in 2017. Obviously, we've done a lot of work since then.
Yeah, I mean, it's too early to speculate on that. I mean, we have obviously our internal models that we are working on pretty much every day. But until anything is published, I obviously need to be very careful about what I say. But, you know, the key things to take away are, you know, we talked about the tungsten price. That obviously is probably the most material thing, because if you take the price from 300 to, let's just say, you know, 450 or 475 or 500, whatever the number gets to, or potentially a lot higher, you can imagine that affects the outputs pretty dramatically. So that's a big part of it. And one thing that I've said before is, even if we didn't find another MTU of tungsten, right? Based on the 2018 resource that's in place right now. Even if we didn't find another MTU of tungsten or ton or whatever metric you want to use.
Yeah.
This is the most, in our view, the most important asset in the USA. This can produce a very material amount of tungsten based on the 2018 numbers alone. And that's why this is such an important story that we have here, an important asset, because that's if we just took the 2018 numbers and just updated the price and went. But we've done a lot of work since then. A big part of what we're doing is, you know, the open pit at Desert Scheelite, we believe will be, you know, our view is that it obviously carries water at the previous price floor of, let's call it, $300 an MTU. So as the price continues to move, that continues to get more attractive. So obviously the mill and mill site and the build out of an actual mine here, we believe would be supported by Desert Scheelite alone and the CapEx without a doubt. However, you know, our view is to build something that's much bigger than that. And that's why we've drilled the Garnet Zone. So that's a zone kind of about a mile away from where the central processing plant would be, the mill site. On top of that, you know, Pilot North is a new zone that we've staked. It's 15 kilometers away. So we're blending exploration with development. We have what we need at Desert Scheelite to move forward with confidence, but by exploring as well, and I know a lot of companies, they get kind of stuck in this boring part of the Lassonde curve where they're just developing and they get a press release every, you know, 6 months about, we just commissioned this. No, that's, we're going to be doing all that stuff. That is our plan. But at the same time, we're going to continue to explore and drill and make new discoveries, because that can increase the mine life, or also it can increase the throughput of material through that mill in a production scenario, which would allow us to produce more WO3 for the US market. So hopefully that kind of answers your question. But yeah, I mean, it's all coming together. What we have is incredibly valuable, US national security, and now most importantly, with the support and backing of the Department of Defense in the United States.
You know, you spent too much time in the United States, because that was a true politician's answer. Did you not answer the question? But I'm aware there's some questions, especially at this stage, that you can't answer. Yeah. And that's fine, you know. Yeah. I think for me, it's almost like, I'm trying to think of the word. I mean, we were talking before we came online about various analogies, but for me, it's the dog that's caught the car. After 2 years of chasing it, we finally got the initial grant funding. Presumably, I mean, the way I believe that it works in the US, you get an initial grant to get you to whatever stage you need to go to first. For us, it's the pre-feasibility study, and then you can get more grant funding potentially once that lands. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I won't comment on anything specific to Guardian Metal Resources.
But just generically.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at other companies as examples, and not to say that this will apply to us by any means, but, you know, you look at Perpetua Resources, that's a good example. So, you know, we Perpetua has become, in our view, sort of the champion of U.S. antimony. And antimony is a very key input metal for defense as well, alongside tungsten. So Perpetua, I don't know the exact numbers, but they have received multiple awards over the last, I think it's probably 18 months. And they've also received support from the Ex-Im Bank. And then you look at MP Materials, and someone told me this the other day, but MP got an original award. I don't know when it was, let's just call it 2.5 years ago, for I think it was sub $10 million.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, fast forward to 2 weeks ago, and they got, I don't know the final total, but, you know, it's hundreds, if not over $1 billion in total support through multiple avenues, including a pretty amazing price floor that makes sure that, you know, any anti-competitive tendencies globally won't affect their ability to sell the product. So what I'm trying to say is, we've seen the blueprint laid out for what an antimony champion looks like in the US, what a rare earth champion looks like in the US. And really, you know, it's also important to note that we are now the only US company with US assets to receive DPA-3 US DoD support. So our goal now is to become and position ourselves as the champion of US tungsten. And we believe the assets to do that. And obviously the backing and support from the DoD award helps us get towards that goal.
I guess I've got a couple more kind of like broader scale questions. I mean, this is a two-parter. So the first part is, Guardian Metal, obviously as strategically important as it is there a reasonable chance that you get either bought out voluntarily or not, because they need to expand production of tungsten as quickly as possible? But given, you know, the US and China tariff conversations, Trump found out very quickly that critical minerals was the US's Achilles heel. Mm-hmm. And then the second part of the question, again, is related to China, but China has been supporting its own production and processing of critical minerals for decades, right? Undercutting Western producers. And now MP Materials is a good example of this. The US has set a price floor, which I think is double what the current price is for those rare earths. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to other Western competitors who are investing privately? Or is this something that the US and the Western world in general has to do to compete with China?
Yeah, great questions. So number one, on the buyout side of things, you know, yes, absolutely, it's possible. I think we have a very unique and special offering. I mean, if you canvass the US for other tungsten companies, you know, in our view, and I think, you know, objectively, a lot of investors will come to realize that we do occupy the pole position when it comes to US tungsten, which is a fantastic position to be in, given, you know, what we just talked about with the champions of some other key defense metals, what they've done with that positioning. But, you know, we don't have the for sale sign up. We have put together a team of engineers and a board that can actually go and build these mines. And that is our intention and our plan. We want to deliver mine tungsten to the US. However, with that being said, as we continue to de-risk and push these projects forward, I mean, yeah, I think I'd be crazy to not assume that we become a pretty attractive takeover target, because, you know, we have the two kind of, we believe, key assets, which are moving forward to production. So we'll see what happens. You know, we're a commercial board and we look at everything. But like I said, our goal is to deliver mines in America tungsten. That's really our goal here. And we'll see what happens along that path. And then the subsidies, I mean, you absolutely nailed it there, Charles. That is why we're in a position where China, Russia, and North Korea account for 90% of total global tungsten. Right, or rare earths, yeah, or antimony, or germanium,
or lithium, name them all. Yeah,
the list goes on. Graphite. The list goes on and on and on. And now, what is happening is rightfully so. The Western world, and especially the US, is waking up and going, wait a second, we can't be a global superpower and be reliant on countries like, you know, unfriendly adversaries for key input metals, because at any point, that is the trump card. No pun intended, right? Yeah. Because if those metals don't flow into the US, you can't manufacture, you can't build certain things. If one of those metals is missing, you can't just go, well, we're going to replace it with, you know, a little piece of plastic and off we go. No, it doesn't work like that, right? So yeah. it's this position now where China holds this card where they can just stop the flow, and that's what they've done. They've completely shut the taps off when it comes to tungsten and a few other key metals. And you're exactly right. The way they've done this is by subsidizing the mining industry. They've been able to put money. The government has put money into these mines to make sure that regardless of price, they can continue to mine and produce these metals. So what we're seeing on the flip side is to combat that, you almost need to apply the same tactics, and you need the government to come in and support projects, which is what we're seeing right now that we've received our DPA award. That is the government coming in and saying, hey, to enable to combat this, we have to now play some of or do some of the same things. And also that MP award that we discussed and what you alluded to was a price floor. That goes such a long way in this industry. And the announcement and what we've seen subsequent to that is effectively they're looking to do that across the industrial base and across multiple metal supply chains, especially for defense purposes. Because if we can, receive a price floor, let's just call it $500 an MTU. Well, imagine what that does for our project and our ability just to operate long term without worrying about, there's some dumping happening here and the prices drop below a certain level, right?
Yeah,
I think potentially those price floors or the price floors that we've seen for rares is potentially the most impactful thing that was in that announcement.
Yeah,
for that company and the ability for the US continue to produce rares into the future.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, antimony, a couple of rare, I think it was germanium and gallium, tungsten, titanium, graphite happened. I think titanium may be next, but obviously you haven't got exposure to that, but I think it's coming down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to kind of Guardian specifically, now we've set the scene.
Mm-hmm.
You just raised another on the same day. It was 15.6 million UK or 21 million US dollars from UK, your largest investor and shareholder. So they've got a very sizable stake in the company now. And I'm very happy for them to do so, because UCAM, they work companies hard, to be fair. But on the other hand, they're there as very supportive investors if you do the work. And I guess the question is, okay, so you've got this $21 million from UCAM, you've got a $6.2 million grant, so it's $27.2 million. There was a few million in the bank as well. And I guess the question is, what next? What next? Tenpai, which you acquired, was it earlier this year or late last year? It was earlier this year. That was when it went through. And that was previous, I think up until the 80s, I think it was the largest tungsten producing mine in the country. I mean, mm-hmm. there's water issues, and if anyone who wants to go on YouTube, you can explore the site, mm-hmm. Because a lot of people illegally went into the tunnels and took lots of films, which is exciting as a shareholder. But and the question is, what are you going to do with this money? Is it pre-feasibility study for Pilot Mountain and optimizing it to the best of your ability, and more capital goes into that? Mm-hmm. Is it using the money to explore Tempe or update the buildings? Is it trying to get equity and debt and get into production as quickly as possible at Tempo? And I guess that's the question. What do you do with this amount of capital? Because you haven't been this highly capitalized since the company started. And now I guess you have more options than ever before.
The answer is all the above. the mandate that we have received from shareholders, from government, from other industry participants is go and go fast. So that amount of money, that amount of capital allows us to go fast. I just want to quickly just touch on, you mentioned water issues. So there is some water in some of the underground mines, but that's quite typical in these situations. And you pump that out. So just to be clear, there's no lingering water issues. It's just a matter of dewatering. But no, to answer your question, Charles, all of the above, and to do it all fast. So for instance, we have now another rig that we've secured that's going to be allocated for Tempai Ute. We believe that we have two assets that can be in production before Trump leaves office. And what that means is we need the capital to do everything all at the same time. And we have not had that ability up until earlier last week.
2 days ago.
Earlier last week, right? Up until then, the most amount of capital we had ever raised, I believe, was 2.7 million US.
Yeah.
And so now we've raised effectively, or now we have in the bank almost 10x that, or more than 10x that. So if investors have followed the story, they'll probably say that, we're a pretty active business over the last 2 years, and that's on limited cash reserves with no direct support from the Department of Defense DPA-3 program. Now we have we find ourselves in a very different position. And effectively, we are going to go much faster than we were going before. Now, a lot of the work streams that we need to tackle now are more expensive, and that's part of the process. But to answer your question, we are going to plow a lot of that money into Tempai Ute. There's tremendous opportunity there, so we're going to be going quick there. We have the team now in place for Tempai Ute drilling. We're going to have the drill rig on site hopefully very soon. Pilot Mountain, continue to push forward there. There's many, many new zones that we want to go after as part of our exploration strategy. There's obviously the key PFS and engineering work streams that we can work with now in collaboration with the Department of Defense and moving those forward as quickly as we can. And really what we're just trying to get to is both these projects to an FID as soon as we can, because then we can go and raise the construction capital and actually put these into production. And, you know, the CapEx numbers we believe for both these projects is, you know, order of magnitude, very, very achievable, given, you know, what a lot of global mining projects need. So to answer your question, we're going to go fast. We're going
to
do it all.
We'll interrupt you though. I mean, my guess, and you may not be able to comment, but my guess for Tempai getting it back into production against the brownfield site, around $50 million. Is that roughly in the right ballpark? Or you can blink twice for yes, once for no.
What I can say there is that, you know, we have a plethora of existing infrastructure that we can utilize in a restart directly. So it's, I mean, your order of magnitude, I think you are correct. Our numbers internally are, it's very achievable, let's just say. So I don't think you're too far off there, Charles, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things is in the mining space, that's nothing, right? So we're going to go quick. And the other thing I didn't mention is, you know, some of that capital we can utilize towards, you know, increasing our exposure in the US, right? And a big part of that is achieving a senior US listing where, you know, the likes of Perpetua and MP, that's where they trade and that's where the investors go to for exposure to those metals. Yeah. So, you know, a big part of what we're doing now is running towards a senior US listing as quickly as we can as well, which is where we think, you know, we need to go with this story, obviously.
Well, it's the corporate side, isn't it? Because the UK investor pool is enthusiastic, but arguably relatively small compared to the US, compared to Australia, compared to Canada, mm-hmm. when it comes to resource. Yeah. And also the company story is getting bigger. It's a lot bigger than what it was a couple of years ago, especially with the DoD grant.
Yeah.
So on the corporate side, I guess there's two questions. The first is, in terms of expanding the footprint, you've just taken on Pilot North, and there's quite exciting stuff going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, across Nevada, there was maybe 50 mines operating up until the end of the Korean War. You know, Tempai, just the district alone, 600,000 tons of ore, you know, mainly from a Lincoln mine produced mm-hmm. before it shut down in the 1980s.
Yep.
And I guess there's very few companies out there with the ability or the connections to stake, you know, these historic deposits. And, you know, this is the first part of the question. How much more do you want to expand your footprint, given mm-hmm. how cheap staking is?
Mm-hmm.
And the second point is more on the financial side is, when you want to achieve that senior US listing, generally there's a lot of requirements, but one of them is to have a share price / market capitalization at mm-hmm. a certain level. How do you want to achieve that? Do you want to get there organically through growth, or would you like to shortcut it with, you know, some kind of consolidation of shares? Because I don't know, up to you, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So first question is staking. I mean, I'd love to stake it all. And obviously
the whole of Nevada, everything outside of Vegas.
I mean, it's such a mineral rich state. I'd love to own the whole thing if I could. But no, to answer your question, the way that we look at staking is the key for us is to go fast. And there's a lot of, as you mentioned, there's a lot of tungsten prospectivity in the US and in Nevada. We believe we have the two most important assets right now, but there are a lot of other assets now outside, let's just call it a circle of radius of 25 miles away from our current projects.
Well, the Pine Creek area or Black Rock, Humboldt County, you know, the whole of Nevada is just surrounded by the stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. But the key thing, once again, for us is to go fast, because if there's a grassroots project in Northeast Nevada, you know, they're going to be 10, 15 years away from production if they find anything. Whereas we have two assets that can, we believe, be in production before Trump leaves office. And the key thing is anything that's within a certain proximity of those deposits, we could, in theory, fold into the broader operation.
Yeah.
So for instance, Pilot North is 15 kilometers away from Pilot Mountain. Therefore, if we find something at Pilot North, that could be that could form part of the broader economics of Pilot Mountain. So we're really focused on opportunities that are, I would say, proximal to our existing two main projects.
Yeah. And then the second part of the question on potential share consolidation or organic growth to get to those minimum requirements for a senior US listing.
Yes. So to answer that question, we're open-minded. You know, there's a certain time when you actually need to have that those metrics figured out and complete it. So, you know, if a consolidation is required, we'll do that. If anything, in the US, investors actually look more favorably on higher share prices versus the UK investors are looking for, you know, they're looking for, you know, 1p shares. So this is going to become a much more American story than it already is, and especially on the capital market side as well. So if you know, our bankers in the US advise us that, you know, a share price of is where you want to be with this, and we've seen Almonte, another tungsten company, do a consolidation, then we'll do that to make sure that we put ourselves in the best position to deliver on the US market when we do get there. Now, we do have the OTC market right now, which is a great conduit right now, but we think a big board listing is key here for our company.
100%. Okay. I mean, we could talk about Tempo Ute forever. I guess my last question on the tungsten, and I just got one question on the Garfield off that, and then I'm done, because we could be here for hours.
Yeah, for sure.
Two more questions and I'm done. When it comes to sort of production, is your plan to have a production hub at Tempo Ute, and then anything that is potentially produced at Pilot Mountain is just trucked over because it's relatively close by? Or are you looking for, you know, I don't know, a satellite plant and then the main plant? Or are you not quite there yet with your planning?
Yeah, so we're looking at all options right now. We do think that both projects, given what is in the ground and what we think will be in the ground, will justify having their own mine and mill and processing facility. Now, in terms of trucking or from one project to another, that is something that you typically can do if you, as sort of an intermediate step to say, hey, you know, we want to start producing here and we have a mill. It's not going to be quite as economic. So there is the possibility of going one of those routes if it means we can get potentially some units into the market quicker. But I think longer term, both of these projects deserve their own commercial operation, and that includes the mill and processing facility to go along with it.
And then final question. That's a really good answer, because I was expecting you to say one, to be honest. But two, fantastic. Yeah. Three, great. Final question is just on additional projects. So we've had Golconda and Garfield. The gold price is pretty much at record highs. Copper is just racing ahead, almost at $6. Yeah. These are secondary projects to the company. And yet, I can't help but feeling, given how much capital you've just raised, that some exploration of these projects is going to be justified, just because anything you find, if it's economic, will be very good value for you.
Yeah, so it's a good question. What do we do with those assets? So
don't say anymore, Oliver. You're a tungsten company. That's the end of it.
No, that's fine.
We are a tungsten company. No, what I can say, I mean, it is important to cover those because they are fantastic assets. We have, as you can imagine, interested parties in both of those assets, Golconda and Garfield. We are in a position now of strength, obviously, where we don't need to rush to monetize those and get a bit of cash and shares to cover our operations. That's what happens a lot of times with companies, is they'll part ways with good secondary assets to cover the spend on the first assets. Yeah. We don't have to do that. So it's, I know investors want to see things happen with those assets. We are, you know, we're still open to doing some further work to prove things up. But what I'm trying to get to is, we want to find the way to best monetize those assets, because our shareholders deserve to see them monetized in one way or another. Now, there are, you know, in our view, Golconda and Garfield would constitute a fantastic earlier stage Nevada exploration company with principally focused on gold and copper. So, you know, we look at all options. We want to monetize those. So if the right deal comes along, we would certainly do that. But in the interim, you know, the price of the metal, underlying metals, continues to go up. And, you know, the concept of, you know, potentially a spin out, right? Having those in their own vehicle.
I was about to say the same thing, Oliver.
Yeah.
Spin it out.
Retain the shareholding, you know, and just be a pure tungsten company with upside exposure that you don't have to worry about.
Yeah. So I won't say more than that, but those are the kind of things that we're looking at. And obviously, the last couple of weeks have just been focused on getting to where we're at now. But we, you know, we have people on the team who can be dedicated towards exactly that, which is find the best ultimate outcome for those assets. And, you know, a spin out or a sale, I like the spin out idea, to be completely honest. Mm. So yeah, I mean, we'll continue to push those forward. And what I can do is I can guarantee to listeners and our investors that we will monetize those in the best interest of our shareholders.
Lovely to chat to you, Oliver. Over to you.
So, Oliver, I'm going to ask you the questions that everybody wants the answers to, okay? So you're currently sitting in a market capitalization of £91.5 million after this raise, and you've got $27 or $28 million of money. So in £20 million, let's say, plus a few million that you already had. How much, if Tenpaiute and the other asset are producing, how much tungsten are you going to be producing annually? I know you already know this because you must have planned. What's the plan? How much tungsten is going to be produced?
Yeah, so I need to be careful. Like, we need to confirm those numbers in the PFS.
Give us a ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of give you a few guiding data points here, which will help out. So, for instance, at a million, and anyone could run these numbers themselves, at the current grade we have at Pilot Mountain, if you were to run effectively a million tons of material through a mill and you recovered a reasonable amount of material, that would equate to about 2,000 tons of WO3. So that is ballpark what about 20% of the US annual requirements.
Okay, and that is for each Pilot Mountain and Tenpaiute?
So that's just Pilot Mountain. Moving over to Tenpaiute, if you take the, and once again, any engineer could do this calculation if they want to. So I'm just giving you numbers that are in the public domain. Tenpaiute, based on the size of the mill and based on you know, historical production records, which are in the public domain, the historic grade produced, which is about 0.45% WO3, that equates to about another 2,000 tons of WO3. So I'm not saying that's what we're going to do on either.
But that would only be at 50 million tons per annum going through then. Or 50.
I'm not commenting on throughput through Tenpaiute, but it was a historical producer based on the mill foundations and the grade of rock. It's about a 2,000 ton per year.
Okay.
Global producer.
So dance on a tightrope.
Let me just finish that for you. So that is, once again, this is not, I'm not saying we're going to do this, but just giving you in the public domain numbers, that is about 4,000 tons of tungsten per annum. And that is about 40% of what the US needs every year. That's previously what China used to import. And then on top of that, you know, that doesn't include production from a zone like Garnet or Gunmetal or Good Hope or Pilot North. So anyways, I'm not saying what we're going to do, but just to give investors an order of magnitude estimate data points that they can then use to guide their own analysis of our business.
And remind me how tungsten is priced, because it's not priced the same as like per ton or per, it's priced as at a certain amount of a ton. No?
Yeah, so a ton, I know what you're trying to do here, Kev. Once again, just to be clear, I'm just giving you in the public domain numbers, but a ton of tungsten right now, a ton of WO3 is valued at effectively, you know, I think the current mid price is $47,500.
Okay. So based on that, which is just pure speculation, you're talking about $190 million of revenue just from tungsten. We've got silver, we've got other things that are going to be coming out of the ground, we've got the garnets, et cetera, et cetera. How much is this thing going to be worth?
So just to be clear, you said numbers.
I know you can't answer that
question. I love when Kev, because he always moans at me for asking questions that CEOs can't answer, but he's just asked two and three in a row. Oliver can't answer. So
but
yeah.
I'm putting you on the thing, because I'm looking at this going, we've gone from £7 million market cap to £95 million market cap. And you're telling me that this thing is only just beginning, right? So I want people to understand, why do you think this thing is only just beginning? Because that, in the general gist of things, doesn't make sense.
Well, because the real value is when you're a producing company putting out X amount of thousands of tons of WO3 into a market that desperately needs it, and you get a multiple on revenue, a multiple on your EBITDA, whatever multiple you want to use, that's when the real value comes, right? As we've seen with El Monte, as they move towards commercial production, I mean, they're a north of $1 billion company. So just to be clear, this is Kev's excellent adventure back of the napkin calculation.
No,
which is fine.
Is,
you're doing it. Anyone could do this.
Your speculation.
Based on the numbers that you've put together, you can apply any multiple you want and come up with a future valuation. And, you know, once again, those are your numbers, but you know, it's been guided by things that I've told you that are in the public domain.
Yeah. I mean, basically it looks very positive. I won't say any more because it'll make you feel uncomfortable. So
you always try to get me in trouble, Kev, but yeah, I do a good job dancing around it. So
but I think ultimately what we're trying to do, we're trying to get Pilot Mountain, Tempayute, to hopefully produce somewhere in the region of, let's say, 3,000 to 5,000 tons of well-needed tungsten. You're also going to have some silver. You're also going to potentially have the garnets as things go by. So you're going to be a highly revenue-producing company and also highly profitable, probably, because more than likely, the government's going to help you dig this stuff up, which I think is the unknown. You are not just a company who has found some tungsten is going to have to finance it to dig it up. I think you're going to be in a much better situation than that, just like other companies that have gone before you in other types of metals. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been good to speak to you. Don't say any more, Oliver. And that was all me.
Well, no, you're right, Kev. I mean, we are, as I've mentioned, we're very proud to be the only, you know, DPA3 awarded company focused on U.S. tungsten. And that's important, right? And that, I think, really gives us the confidence to push these projects forward as quickly as we can. So should probably stop talking, but I think the other thing that is really exciting for us is just given the macro, right? And antimony prices have gone up from $10,000 to $60,000 on the back of China export bans, which were put in place, I think, a year and a half ago. The China export bans on tungsten are new. I mean, they're only as of February of this year. And we've seen the price go from 30,000 to almost 50,000, which is only a 50%+ move versus a 6x move. So I'm not saying that's what tungsten's going to do, but I think it's early. It's early innings. It's early innings in the tungsten space, which is another reason why this is so exciting for us.
And I'm looking forward, now that you've said it, for Golden Metal Resources to be spun out and become Golconda and the Cat, and do it all again.
There you go. Well, you can manifest that, Kev. I like it.
I just did. And it's going to list on the 10th of May next year, which is the third anniversary, because it's my birthday of you listing in the UK.
There you go. There's an idea right there. I like that.
There you go. That makes sense. Anyway, we've talked. Do you want to tell us what your Sunday roast is going to be this Sunday? What are you going to eat?
Oh, what am I eating this Sunday? Not a roast, because it's summer, and I think roast in summer just doesn't quite feel right.
No, you're wrong. And a roast at any time of the year is good.
Can I? Well, yeah.
Let's go.
I'm clearly not a true Brit by saying that. I think it's got to be a barbecue. Hopefully the sun's out. Do a little barbecue. There we go. Sorted.
Get the lobster on the barbecue. Now you're feeling. Now you could have a G-Men barbecue for everybody.
Yeah.
Now you can have lobster and caviar because you got 20 million
in the bank. No, Kev. That money's going to the US, to Nevada, to our workers. We keep corporate G&A very tight here, Kev, even with a much healthier bank balance. So
indeed. I jest. Right. Good to speak to you, and I look forward to speaking to you as the news progresses over the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, good stuff, guys. Appreciate it.
Let's move on to our second guest this week. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Daniel G, Priority AI founder. Welcome back to the podcast, Dan. How's life?
Life is very good. Thanks, guys. Lovely to see you again. How's things for you?
Yeah, all good. Busy as ever. Enjoying the weather and everything. And obviously, a little bit of a summer break. How's things for you? Are you doing any daddy daycare or still working hard in the background?
Working hard. Daddy daycare have a lot more staff now, post-Hearthspace integration. Growing team. Office is bursting at the seams, which is fantastic. Doing a bit of time with the kids, but yeah, balancing out the two, but really exciting time for Priority. So there's lots and lots going on over summer. I don't think many of us will be getting away. Knees to the grindstone.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's obviously plenty of news to unpack since Priority were last joined us on the podcast. There's been two key updates to unpack. So earlier this week, the company announced a £250,000 contract win with a subsidiary Halfspace with a Premier League football club to deliver data-led marketing and deploy its Compass ID tech to enhance ticketing and hospitality sales. And today, Priority has launched its own Bitcoin Lightning Network routing node as part of its Pribit product offering, enabling instant, low-cost Bitcoin payments across its SME customer base. Backed by 100 million sats from its treasury, the first node is already live with over 100 successful transactions. The company also plans to launch Ethereum validator nodes for staking in partnership with Coinbase Commerce. So let's start with the contract win, Dan. Just how significant is this Premier League contract for Priority's wider strategy to integrate AI across the sports and entertainment sectors?
I mean, it's firstly fantastic that an organisation, a Premier League club, as a football fan, and we're all football fans here, is trusting us with their data and to deliver tangible results is fantastic. In terms of significance, there is, I guess, somewhat of a herd mentality in sport. So we are having conversations with other clubs, which is very, very positive. Football is not the only sport that we play in. Obviously, you know, we've announced horse racing, EuroLeague basketball, et cetera, et cetera. So we are doing lots and lots in other areas. I think for me, the key takeaway for this product, for this transaction and contract win, is it's not just isolated to the newly incorporated Halfspace products. Actually, that customer is intending to acquire Priority AI products, custom build AI products, and a whole suite of products on top of this package. So it really is a gateway into sharing the Priority ecosystem of a broader range of solutions across data, AI, and growth.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you just give us a sort of rundown on how this Compass ID technology works in practice, you know, how it sort of enhances the fan engagement while remaining GDPR compliant?
Compass ID is Halfspace's proprietary tracking technology. So in effect, laying markers, tags down on visitors as they visit channels, whether that be on the web most popularly, and then enriching those tags with external data sets from the likes of Experian, MasterCard, to gain a better understanding of what that visitor looks like from a cohort perspective, from a data perspective, putting them into a bucket, and then understanding what their consumer behavior looks like, not just putting you, Phil, as a visitor on a Premier League football club website, but actually what makes you tick, where are you spending your money, what kind of demographic you're sitting in, and how can we appeal to you. Then the broader range of Halfspace products is going out and actually controlling that media planning and buying to go, now we understand who you are, to better deploy media into your eyeballs and turn that into ROI. Historically, that Halfspace, that Compass ID product, has delivered several 100% increases in ROI when it's been deployed. So it's fantastically successful. It's super popular. It's proprietary, which is brilliant. And I guess the real kind of secret sauce is that we're actually working on integrating that with the Priority Advisor product offering as well. And we're just about to go into testing live with a customer on that, a mandate for a very well-known organization to actually incorporate the two, AI with data with custom tracking, all proprietary, really exciting project. And I guess speaking to what we already knew, that this is a really good acquisition for us and a merger of great skill sets and minds.
Yeah, very good. And then obviously onto this Bitcoin Lightning Network that was announced recently. I've been trying to sort of work out what problem it's trying to solve or fix. And I'm, you know, bear with me on this, the fact that I don't really use Bitcoin, certainly not for payments. But I'm assuming that normally Bitcoin payments can be pretty slow and expensive. And this Lightning Network is a kind of a faster, cheaper way to send Bitcoin, kind of like using a contactless instead of a chip and pin. Is that a fair summation?
I mean, we'll talk about the reasoning behind it and the background. So background-wise, yeah, you're completely right. If you've ever tried to make a transaction on mainnet, kind of Bitcoin transaction, at a period of congestion, it's time-consuming. It can be expensive. Transactions can take up to 55 minutes to prove up on-chain and could cost anything from $1 to, you know, maybe $10. So they can be expensive, although it's less frictionless than fiat transactions. It has its limits, I mean, it's kind of barriers. Mainnet can process up to 10 transactions a second, is kind of the stat that we're told. In theory, Lightning Network transactions can, if they've got connector nodes within them, perform an unlimited amount of transactions per second at a much lower cost. So you're right, time, speed, scale are the problems that we're solving. By creating our own routing node, what we're doing is giving the ability to our customers within the Priority Network to not only purchase our goods and services at a close to zero and almost instant time and fee, but also to exchange goods and services between each other because we're setting up those channels. So we're encouraging, I guess, democracy within our network, but also collaboration. We're trying to empower SME business owners and collaborators to kind of work together to share some of the good work they're doing and actually do it without the worry of kind of fees or time or cost or friction. The way that it works, the best way to think about layer two solutions or a Lightning Network is a branch off of the main net. So you've got your main net, you've got a branch that comes off, you have an opening balance. It's like opening a new tab on a spreadsheet. All the transactions that happen within there are completely off of that main net. So completely private, completely secure, and being processed within those routing node channels. At the point that we close that node, we have a connector that goes back up and we have a closing balance. So you're in effect, you've got this side ledger, which is occurring. The way that works is connector nodes, similar to validators, 6 degrees of separation. Say that you and Kev are transacting with each other, but you don't directly know each other. I've got a channel set up between the two of you. I can in effect act as a routing node for a fee. For you to send a payment to Kev in Bitcoin, and I'll charge a base fee for that. So it's a liquidity fee. You'll raise an invoice, Kev will raise an invoice. The transaction will occur between the two of you, but actually there could be an infinite number of channels that sit between that. And by providing those channels, we're earning a fractional fee in a small number of sats, which we'll set to provide liquidity into the network. So by setting up our own node, we're providing liquidity, we're creating connections with our customers. And as the announcement says, we put 100 million sats out of our existing Bitcoin treasury to start with into providing liquidity so we can go and patch other channels within the network and earn some passive income.
Yeah. So that's what I wanted to get onto next is there's probably a few listeners thinking, what is a sat? You know, Bitcoin is broken into these tiny little pieces called Satoshis or sats. And obviously, as you said, one Bitcoin is 100 million sats. So I guess when Priority says that it has put 100 million sats into the system, it means you've effectively dedicated one full Bitcoin to keep that kind of payment channels flowing smoothly, almost like a float in a till, if you will.
Exactly. One of the most difficult things, and I've been in Web3 now, I think 4 or 5 years across various different companies, kind of bought and sold. And when you're running nodes, one of the most difficult things, as you say, with that ledger is rebalancing. A lot of people that run unprofitable nodes, because every time we rebalance, we have to go back up to that main net, which is the expensive and time consuming transaction. Everything that happens on your layer two is relatively cheap and cost free. What you don't want is a big skew on the balance of payments, loads of cash flow in or loads of cash flow out. And so we want to keep that float, as you say, by dedicating that 100 million sats of liquidity to begin with. It means that we don't have to constantly rebalance these channels. We're dealing with, and as I say, this network, this routing node is intended for our customers. You know, you touched it earlier. Our contracts are becoming larger and larger. If you haven't noticed, as we deal with bigger and bigger customers, as we're talking about the adoption of Web3, we need to have infrastructure in place that some of our larger customers can actually start to use some of these Web3 solutions, and we've got the liquidity behind it. And so the intention is that this is a moving target, a growing target. And as I say, to start with, we've put 100 million sats out of our Bitcoin treasury into providing liquidity. And as demand grows, we'll move more of our treasury towards providing liquidity.
So Dan, tell me how you perceive that SMEs are going to use this and what, if any, interest have you had from larger SMEs? I mean, we're talking about companies who could be worth £1 billion, have lots of revenue. I mean, do you expect that some of those people will put, you know, a few million pounds in Bitcoin to have a treasury as well?
I mean, we're sports fans, right? And we've probably seen the news from PSG over the last week or so where Paris Saint-Germain have bought a large portion of Bitcoin for no particular reason, just because they want exposure to the space, which is probably a better answer than I could give you, Kev, of do we see big organizations doing this? Well, actually, they're already doing it. I could give you the reason why I think they should, but actually people are talking with their wallets. We are seeing larger and larger organizations become intrigued and adoptive of certain technologies. I guess we had this with AI when we started our journey of speaking to big organizations saying, right, we don't quite get it. There's an educational process that happens there, but people are becoming less and less sensitive to some of the nuances and actually seeing there is a tangible use case for this. When you can start to show people, okay, well, you can move cash about within this ecosystem quicker, cheaper, less friction, and that actually displays on their bottom line. Okay, well, I'm saving some processing fees. You know, we use Stripe as our acquirer. That might cost us anywhere between 1% and 2% to make an acquired transaction for our SaaS products. Well, okay, well, if we transact using the Lightning Network, that goes to, in effect, you know, a couple of cents. That's a real tangible benefit for us, and it's all EBIT, in effect. So once you start talking, I guess, to the finance heads within organizations and going, okay, this might look a bit unusual, but you can actually save time and money here, it becomes very compelling and hard to, I guess, argue against. And as the bigger players, you know, PSG, great example in the sports space, because we're doing a lot of work in there at the moment, the big organizations will be voting here and becoming more crypto friendly. And we're really well positioned to capitalize on that as that feeds down to your mid-tier SMEs, your small SMEs. So yeah, we've gone a little bit early, and we're putting the foundations in pretty kind of early in the day to make sure that we've got robust, advanced infrastructure at the point where everyone goes, right, I want to start putting this in my business. How do I get about it? We've already got a suite of products to help you.
So when we came to market in the beginning of the year, you were very much small SMEs, let's get the numbers going. But we've seen, obviously, with Halfspace and also even yourselves, with the charity sector side of things, that not that that's not going to happen, but it's obviously more profitable for the business to get £100,000 contract than it is to get a £1,000 per month contract. So do you see that continuing?
I think there's body and tail, Kev. If we go back to back many, many years ago when I started out building kind of businesses and going through mentors and going through, you know, how to build a profitable and successful business. I think the good thing about the Halfspace acquisition is we've brought guys in that have all got histories of operating businesses, such as, you know, such as me as well. We've all worked out how to monetize very, very well, which is, I think, a USP. Looking around at public companies, lots don't have operators within them. Great concepts, but not actual operators that have got proven track record of creating kind of, you know, cash for shareholders. But we look at the body and the tail. I think that body for us is always that recurring revenue. When we come to market, we talked about ARR. How can we cover the overheads of the business without ever stepping into the office? Well, ARR is that. And we've got a SaaS product that people like and buy. Economies of scale, the margins are a lot higher on that product because we own all the IP. So we're looking at the 91, 92% margins on those products. The consultancy, the project work, there's a bit more work involved, takes a bit more time. So it's about really nurturing both sides of that, making sure the body's there to cover kind of the day-to-day operations. And the tail is your high ticket stuff, you know, talking about Premier League football clubs, multinational organizations, where they are six figures. You know, we spoke £250,000 for the first stage of that Premier League football club product. And then we've got projects that sit around it as well. Having that body of recurring revenue from the SaaS product allows us the time and flexibility to explore some of these bigger ticket items, which is why I think we're starting to build out that perfect kind of revenue pyramid, where we've got lots of customers at the bottom, at low ticket, all the way up to the top of the pyramid, where we've got these really high price point, one or two handful of kind of ultra profitable customers for us with kind of big projects. So it's all about building out that pyramid.
So have you got the best team in football history in England on the cards, then you're going to sign up Liverpool or not?
That's turned down, Kev. Unfortunately, we've got an onboarding process and I feel unsure. No, we're talking to lots of
somebody teams. Stole your hubcaps while you were down there, didn't you?
We've got lots of teams in the Prem. We've got lots of teams abroad. It's fantastic. As, you know, sports fan, you know, James and I, as co-founders of this business, originally came out of a kind of Web3 sport media investment vehicle because that's our passion. So it's a dream. You know, I was over in Portrush last week with the guys from Scottish Golf and, you know, speaking to the guys at the PGA. It's a, I guess, pinch yourself that not only in your room with these guys, but they want to deploy their balance sheet cash to buy your tech. It's fantastic. And, you know, if Liverpool come knocking, we'll consider opening the door. I'm not sure yet.
We're buying everything else at the minute, so why not come and buy you as well?
Not sure their pockets are that deep, Kev.
Indeed. Well, from the point of view, if we take it away from sport, how do you envisage? Because for me now, I see that you obviously sport orientated because of the Halfspace thing, and also, yes, it's your passion. But what about the enhancement of the charity sector, being able to create revenue ongoing from this?
I mean, charity close to my heart. I've been in charity space now for 4 to 5 years as various projects, as ambassador for a few. All of this stuff, it's nice when you're working in sectors that you've got an affinity to. We're a growing team of nearly 20 now, so there's lots and lots of kind of passion. We're actually launching our first ever charitable giving day, so our annual charitable giving day next Tuesday, whereby a lot of the team will be out at Whitechapel Mission cooking for the homeless at 4 a.m. So huge shout out to the team for taking their personal time at 4 a.m. on a Tuesday to go and give back. But doing things like this and initiatives like this firstly shows the buy-in of the staff of what we're doing and what we're trying to achieve. But I think outside of that, you know, we've predominantly done a lot in retail and hospitality sector. You know, working with customers like Broadwick a couple of weekends ago for their Silverworks project with 30, 40,000 people, doing partnership work across food and beverage brands, across hospitality brands, travel and leisure brands. I think we're probably genuinely sector agnostic across most of the products, particularly those priority range, priority advisor, the generative platform. We see a mix of people using that product across sectors, some public companies, some private. When we have a particular interest or a particular vein where there is a real tangible use case, obviously Leukemia Care is a fantastic flagship client for us. We're currently talking about entering for a couple of innovation awards for the use case of our product in what they're trying to achieve, which is brilliant and only goes kind of, I guess, speaking to, I guess, the happiness of the customer who's actually using the product, that they're getting, you know, much more than they expected out of it. But also it's a nice stake in the ground for us in certain industries to say, look, these people are using it. They love it. They're actually kind of winning accolades. Why aren't you guys doing it? Why aren't you guys using AI in your day-to-day operations? Why aren't you saving money, time, scaling without the need to get these big retained growth agencies in? And people are going, well, actually, that's a really good question. Why aren't we? And so I guess it means that, you know, we're getting a lot more inbound, a lot more interesting conversations. The sales and procurement team are very, very busy. But if you ask me what's going to be our biggest sector in the next 18 months, I could guess sport, I could guess travel and leisure, hospitality. But ultimately, you know, consumers are the one buying the products, right? So I'm just here to make sure that the development team fulfills the growing demand.
And do you see that there is a way forward for people with this small language model, that they're actually seeing the benefit from that in the companies?
There's not a lot of case studies for big ticket stuff. No, we're just working on a few new products at the moment, one in particular for the aforementioned Premier League club, another for a couple of smaller organizations, some work for Leukemia Care. There's no real big flagship, you know, £100 billion company that says we've put AI and we've saved 80% of our margin. On the smaller side, we see tons and tons of usage. And so our internal case study, absolutely fantastic. And we'll be actually releasing a few of those when we do our vision setting day internally next week on the Tuesday, then our charitable day of talking to the staff. Actually, here's people tangibly using our product. We are seeing efficiencies across time, across scalability, across revenue, people having the ability to go and plug a bit more cash into their business because they're not spending loads of money on things like translation, big area for us, where we've got a lot of travel and leisure brands saving on translation. Everyone's getting really tangible benefits. People are very, very happy. I guess the interesting thing for us is that these small LLMs, these custom vectors, databases that are being built for businesses, instantly become bigger the second they start getting used. And people don't realize how much data they're actually collecting every single day running their business, whether it's their staff, their stakeholders, their social content, you know, their channels, you know, whether the bulletin boards of public companies. People just don't realize how much engagement there is with their business. And actually, we're turning that into actionable insights, which is really exciting. And some of our small customers have actually come to be quite big customers because they're collecting, they've got such brilliant communities that are powering their growth. Those models, that training data is growing, 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 and they're building their IP every single day, which is fantastic for us, building a moat around their business, saying, right, this is your community, and it's actually your tool to go and use to get bigger. So really great results, real tangible. Do I see a way forward? Absolutely. Do I see future development? Yes, we're just about to launch a whole load of them. And that's just going to keep going and going because we're in a really exciting tech space where innovation is being encouraged and championed, especially by big companies.
Yeah, we were in Germany recently visiting a field visit for GreenX, and they have a big copper project there that has a lot of historical data. And I was talking to them about your product. And they were very excited about it, actually, because they don't want the data
being put to a large language model and then effectively escaping. So they, I must introduce you to them, but yeah, I can see that having your own small language model to protect your information so it doesn't become part of the overall system is really a key selling point in all of this, I think, for businesses. And I don't think I think many people haven't quite clicked this yet, because you're basically giving away everything every time you stick in something into ChatGPT. What's your thoughts on that?
Data ownership is very important. I guess we're kind of, if we look at our bigger customers, and you know, it feels like a lifetime ago now, but when we first partnered with Halfspace on our Capitano joint project, that was in effect a hybrid solution for large organizations that had sporadic data across multiple repositories, different languages, in effect, big organizations, big data, right? And their big key, as you say, is I don't want it going out into the ether. It's data compliant, it's GDPR compliant, maybe it's SOC 2 compliant, I don't know, depends on the organization. But by losing that, by moving it elsewhere, we lose all of that badging. So Capitano is a secure way to host all your data. We've been talking to Amazon through AWS about creating kind of an AWS native product for that. So all of the architecture sits within there, which they're very, very supportive of. But I think it's really, really important to be able to be sure, and we've just engaged with an international betting company with exactly that requirement. They've got marketing data, media data, obviously consumer data. They've got media spend, algorithmic spend. It's across multiple locations and they want to query it all in real time. To date, that product hasn't existed in the world. Capitano solves that problem, and it solves it in a way that the ownership of that data always sits with that customer. We're processing the data on their behalf, but ultimately the data is their IP and they're retaining it at all times. So that is really kind of the idea behind it. You know, data is your most valuable asset. There's an old saying, Kev, that I say to everyone, I get told to be quiet. Data is like garbage. You need to know what you're doing with it before you collect it. And that's very, very true. However, if you didn't know what you're doing before you're collecting it, you can give us a bit of cash and we'll help you work out with a product like Capitano.
Sounds good. So just as a last point, how do you feel the next 6 months will go? Now you've got Halfspace going. Do you feel that the potential to get more and more clients over the next 6, 12, 18 months is going to be increasing or decreasing?
It's got to be increasing, right? Otherwise, we're doing the wrong thing. The team's really hungry. We brought Sanjay in, one of the co-founders of Halfspace, to head up as chief revenue officer across the group. He's sitting there putting some monster targets in and also delivering some monster results, which is fantastic. I think we've got the hunger, we've got the product, we've got the growing team, which we're further expanding as well. So everything for us is all systems go. We're in the right space, the right sector, the right time. Trying to just keep kind of knees to the grindstone, sort of ignore that it's summer and still get on with things. You know, traditionally, coming from financial tech space, it's a quiet period, but we're showing no signs of slowing, which is fantastic. So I won't be on a beach next to you, unfortunately, Kev, this year.
Why France, where August is a write-off then?
We must not have a lot of French customers, Phil, because everyone's really active, wants to get things done. We're getting lots of mandates and briefs. So yeah, I think it's a great time to be kind of in the priority tent or the Halfspace tent, and yeah, really exciting and great to have the Halfspace guys on board, and it's exciting times.
Good. You're going to need a bigger HR department and more staff going forward.
We have a fantastic HR and culture department, and Myo heads it up. Is an absolute lifesaver and keeps everyone in check and makes sure everything runs smoothly. But yeah, lots of open vacancies across sales, data, technology. We are growing at a rate of knots to meet up with that customer demand.
Yeah, as long as they're not in attendance at a Coldplay concert, then we'll be fine. So on that note, we'll say Daniel G, Priority AI founder, thanks very much for appearing back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, so we'd like to welcome our third guest today on the Sunday Roast, and that is Sapan Guy from Sovereign Metals, who we had a fantastic Indian meal with last Friday. And actually, it was the meal that he said would be his Sunday roast, and he was right. It was spectacular. So welcome, Sapan.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Charles. Hi. Good to be here.
Yeah, and I will pass you over now to Charles, who's going to grill you on your Sunday roast.
Sapan, I'm not going to grill you on your Sunday roast. I do think that a Sunday roast should be an actual roast, but that's neither here nor there. Most recent RNS, DFS progressing well. I didn't read the rest of it, to be honest. It's all I really needed to see. But completion of geotechnical program, you know, extensive geotechnical investigations, over 400 individual tests. It just keeps getting better and better, doesn't it? I mean, all of this test work that you're doing is being fed in this definitive feasibility study. It's going to drop in Q4, and then the clock starts ticking.
Yeah, thanks, Charles. Look, we've been a little bit quiet on the old RNS front in recent weeks, but that's not to say that things aren't progressing, things aren't advancing on the ground, and that's clearly, you know, what we wanted to get across in this latest RNS, that things are moving ahead. The DFS continues to progress. We're still aiming to have something by Q4 this year. And the geotechnical work is just another tick in the box in getting there, right? So for the lay investor, what do we mean by geotechnical work? Essentially, anywhere where we're going to build a plant, build a dam, build power infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, we want to make sure that, you know, we're not building on land that's going to give or has resource on it or anything like that. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking back to my days as a banker, and there were a few times when companies would, you know, usually run by non-experienced mining executives would essentially start building without having done all the geotechnical work and find out that half their resource is actually underneath their plant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've heard those stories as well.
Yeah.
And look, so we've made sure that we are doing all the right stuff, ensuring that when we're building on land, and in fact, that we're finding material that we can use to engineer some of the infrastructure itself on that land. In terms of preliminary findings, in having done that, what we found is essentially in line with all our theories, all our hypotheses about what that land would look, what that land subsurface geotechnics would look like. So we're quite happy with that. Otherwise, DFS continues. You know, we're very close to figuring out and configuring the final fleet and what that would look like. We're very close to understanding all the power solutions and tariffs around that. We obviously have a very good logistics mine to port solution. So all of that continues. You know, we're having fun and games figuring out what the plant will look like and the positioning of it and the configuration of it. So there's a lot of lovely 3D animations floating around between the team. So all on track.
Well, I enjoy the 3D animations in particular, because often it's they're designed by people who think the budgets are unlimited. And they've got all the bells and whistles and everything possible, you know. But really often, I mean, the thing is, it's kind of funny to me, because there's two routes that you can go down realistically. One is that you publish this DFS in Q4. And I won't hold you to Q4 because I know how DFSs go. But let's say it is Q4. And then 180 days, Rio Tinto has to decide to take operatorship. And then once they take that, they almost certainly want to take ownership. Or alternatively, you build this thing yourself. In which case, you know, the definitive feasibility study and what you might choose to do might look a little bit different. I'd imagine if Rio Tinto took over the company, they'd want to do their own DFS on a much grander scale as well, beyond that. So I guess, what kind of DFS are you trying to publish and create, given those twin potential routes?
Charles, our stance on this has always been the same, which is, as far as we're concerned, Cassia is a sovereign metals project, and we are advancing it as a sovereign metals project that one day we will bring, you know, it into production. Whatever happens at the strategic level, whatever happens in terms of corporate actions along that route, you know, we'll figure those out as they occur. We're not, you know, putting all our eggs in Rio becoming operator or Rio taking this out or any of that. And, you know, I would be doing, and the team would be doing, all our shareholders a disservice if that's what we, you know, we decided was the main strategy. We continue with, as you saw, all the DFS work to get this thing into production. We continue discussions around offtakes to secure customers and potential funding routes. We continue with financing discussions. We continue with discussions at the geopolitical level. And, you know, if we had no reason to build this, then, you know, 2023, when Rio came in, we wouldn't have rejigged the team with a whole bunch of individuals who, you know, between them have built about 13 mines in the last 20 years. So for us, it's a case of business, you know, business as usual. We're just continuing moving Cassia forwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you were talking about on the geopolitical scale, and I know you don't like talking about this too much, but obviously the two critical minerals you have there, rutile, titanium, but also graphite. Graphite was exposed to export controls by China, a long time ago. Antimony, a couple of rare earths, tungsten, relatively recently. It seems to me that titanium is another metal that could get hit by China export controls, which is going to help you. But then on top of that, you probably caught, well, almost certainly read the World Bank note that categorized, I was talking about Malawi in general, but it categorized this here as low, medium risk, was saying that mining could become the largest export sector and significant source of revenues for the country within the next decade. And then there's this direct quote, there are some bright spots in the economy that can drive growth over the medium term, especially through mega projects in the energy and mining sectors. Critical decisions will need to be made in the coming months to ensure that these projects continue to advance. You are, almost certainly, given you were named in there, Kassia is one of those mega projects that's going to be, a significant source of revenue for the next decade for Malawi. And I guess the question is, there's two parts. Is the first, what do you have left to do in terms of data before you can write up the DFS? And second, once the DFS is published, what kind of timeline do you look towards getting towards production, ignoring the Rio angle?
Yeah, so two good questions and lots of good info. You didn't even need me on this.
No, not at all. I've done the research.
Could have left it all to you.
Hey, this is Charles's biggest shareholder, so he knows everything about
Oh,
it.
no. It keeps me awake at night with that.
I'm glad someone keeps up to speed on sovereign metals.
Yeah, well.
Look, so in terms of what's remaining on the DFS, I pointed I talked through a couple of the things we're working on, fleet configuration, et cetera. I think that the key part between now and us getting a DFS out is really the modeling of, the pits and understanding what sequence and which permutation that we start mining the pits in, whether there's an optimal way of us mining those pits. And it's our guys on the ground, all our mining engineers are working through that with the mining geologists at the moment. So I expect once we have that, we can pull everything into essentially the mine model for Kassia, at which point we'd be ready to announce. So, we're just making sure that when we call this a definitive feasibility study, that it is definitive in every way, shape, and form, rather than just a label attached to it. So that's quite key for us. Now, in terms of your second question, and when can we start looking at production? The way I envisage this is 6 months after the DFS, we'll get to a final investment decision. We would have baked in all the financing and the funding required. And then from there, it's probably a 2 to 2.5 year build. So you're looking at 2029, 2030 for first production.
Good. And then the last question from me, because I don't want to take up too much of your time, but Arafura was around the middle of June. Japan's Toho Titanium, which for anyone not in the space is one of the biggest companies in the business, they confirmed that the natural rutile from Kassia is of a quality that can be used without any issues, surpassing requirements for grade with low or no deleterious elements, low radiation value and suitable particle size, distribution, and density. I thought that that RNS would send the share price rocketing. It hasn't yet. It'll get there. But I guess the question is, from your own, in your own words, how important is that statement from Toho to Sovereign?
So let's put this into context, right? So China produces more titanium metal than anyone else, but the titanium metal that China produces cannot be used for specific high quality, high spec uses. I'm not talking golf clubs, I'm talking, within aerospace, within defense. The reason for that is, well, there's a couple of reasons, mainly to do with the feed that China uses and the process it uses to produce titanium metal, but also that titanium metal that then comes out of the back end of a Chinese plant, it can't be forged the way Japanese and Russian titanium metal can, and therefore it can't hit the right specs that are required by the quote unquote Western world for titanium metal. So once you've taken China
The
out of the
equation.
equation, then you're left with only really two other nations that produce the high spec stuff. Russia, and we don't buy Russian titanium anymore, unless you're Airbus and you've got one, a specific kind of whitewash to do so, and Japan. So, and in Japan, you have two main titanium producers, Osaka Titanium, and the one we mentioned in that RNS, which is Toho Titanium. So to put it into context, Toho produce between Osaka and Titanium and Toho Titanium, they produce the absolute majority of aerospace grade, defense grade titanium metal. So for those guys to then turn around and say, if we used Kaseya's rutile as a feedstock to produce titanium metal, we would hit all our spec, is a massive win for us. Right, it absolutely validates what we have in the ground can be used for that high-spec titanium industry. So when you're talking to people who are looking at the growth in the aerospace industry, the growth in the defense industry, when they're looking at reindustrialization of Europe, the US, etc., and you're talking about all these lovely charts that are all pointing upwards, and the fact that titanium is critical to getting those charts to point upwards, well, those guys who are producing the titanium are ultimately, in my opinion, going to be taking their raw materials from us.
Well, it's pretty much, I mean, I know you can't say it, maybe you can, but it's almost an indication of offtake intent from Toho, isn't it?
Well, look, if you look into our previous RNSs, we had previously announced that we had a non-binding MOU for offtake with Mitsui. And you know the way the Japanese kind of heavy industries world works. So you have the likes of Toho Titanium who require raw materials to produce their product. Japan itself doesn't have many raw materials, so they look to the so-called trading houses such as Mitsui to go and procure those raw materials from around the world. So, you know, at that point when we had announced that MOU with Mitsui, it became quite clear, I think, to us and the world that Japan had huge interest in our product.
And then final question from me, and this is kind of a basic question, but often we forget that, you know, the people listening are not titanium specialists. This rutile that you have, with, you know, one of the largest type rutile deposit in the world and the first find, if you have decades and decades, that's now been validated by Toho for these specific high-end use cases. Can you use any other kind of metal for these use cases? Or is it pretty much, it has to be this specific kind of titanium in defense metals?
So there's only two sources of, you know, commercially viable titanium feedstock. Rutile, which is what we have, and that comes out of the ground at 95% titanium dioxide. Or you have ilmenite, which is 30, 40, 50% titanium dioxide and is much more abundant. You know, rutile is very scarce. But in order to get that's ilmenite. So in order to get that ilmenite up to a spec close to rutile, it needs to be smelted or roasted. Lots of carbon intensive, energy intensive work needs to be done on that to get it out there. I mean, one of the simplest analogies I try and use here is, if the world needed steel, as it does, we mine coking coal and we mine iron and we put it together in a smelter and lo and behold, we come up with steel.
Yeah.
So that's your kind of ilmenite process. Now imagine if someone just found a steel mine, right, where you just take this stuff out of the ground.
Yeah.
And that's what rutile essentially is. And that's why, you know, it gets prices 5, 6, 7, 8 times more than
ilmenite. I think you're ramping this up. Be careful. You're going to get called Kevin Hornsby in a minute if you're not careful. My only question is, if Charles has finished that, is when's this going to be worth £1 billion? I'm getting a bit bored waiting.
Well, I think it's when the market realizes the essential inherent value of this project. Yeah, I think one of our shareholders, one of our investors and a good friend, Rick Rule, you know, he always likes to say how, and he's probably said this to you guys, how most of the world can't even spell rutile and have no idea about graphite. So, you know, if you wanted this to be a £1 billion company a year ago, we should have found some gold or copper, right?
But, yeah, you need to have the right asset. But even then, it's not necessarily the case. I mean, you mentioned 28, 29, I think it was, that you're going to go into first production. You know, on the current rutile price and the current graphite prices, what annual revenue will Sovereign Metal be producing based on on the information that you've already done, you know, the previous one?
Yeah, well, we'd be producing something close to about $600 to $700 million a year. And we'd have a gross, an EBITDA margin, gross profits margin of about 63-65% on that. So,
About $400 million EBITDA per annum, correct. Which is like 150 to 160% more than your current market cap. So this is a perfect scenario of Mr. Warren Buffett, which he obviously says that the stock market is a perfect example of changing. What's the word? I will read it rather than remember it, because I put it on the groups this morning. The stock market is a wonderfully efficient mechanism for transferring wealth from the inpatient to the patient.
Now you're sounding like you're ramping it, Kevin.
And I live it. Well, that's my job. What do you think? It's my job. Yours, not your job. You're trying to do me out of a job. And Charles is just sitting there as a shareholder going, I want the thing to go up.
Well, I'm just, the thing is, I'm not particularly stressed about it because I know how the market works. And basically, the RNSs that are going to come out over the next few months and in, you know, the ramp up to that DFS getting published, I imagine they're going to be exciting because you want to create your own competitive tension to Rio Tinto. But basically, the DFS will land. And at that point, everyone in this market is going to say, well, Rio Tinto could buy this any day. They could put an offer in any day. And whether that comes or not, that'll improve the share price. So I'm not worried about it. It's just a waiting game more than anything else.
Yeah. Also, at $1 billion, you've got a share price of £1.65. That's my guess. Answers on a postcard.
Yeah, and whatever offer they put in, just make sure it has a B after it. You know, that's all. But I think it's nothing to. I'm not worried about it at all. Just sit back, relax, and just enjoy the temporary dip that we have. But it's going to pop up pretty soon. Would you agree, Sapan?
Don't say anything, Sapan. You're not allowed.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Sapan. Are you off to the restaurant to have your Sunday lunch on Sunday?
Not today. I only do that with special people, Kevin.
Yeah, you're such a sweet talker. I don't know. I don't think I was a special person. You were with Mr. Swan as well. So.
Indeed.
Okay, well, thanks again, and we look forward to speaking to you in the not-too-distant future. Yeah, with regards to Sovereign Metal and now GreenX, which you will be appearing as in the next few weeks, I think.
Yeah, and looking forward to that one, Kevin. That's quite something. It's very early days, but I think we may have something quite special there too.
Okay.
Thanks, gents.
So, action-packed show. We had Oliver from GMAP. We had Daniel Gee from Priority AI, and we had Sapan from Sovereign Metals. So what's your thoughts? What's been happening this week, Charles? Anything that you'd like to report? I thought I saw something on UFO this week. A couple of people have mentioned it to me. So any thoughts on that or anything else?
Yeah. Alien Metals. I mean, we're working with those guys for a year or so. And basically, they spun out their silver asset, Elizabeth Hill, which was previously the one of the highest grade silver mine in Australia. Now they're drilling there and getting some genuinely fantastic results. But then you also just feel a little bit more confidence in the stock. They had Chris Maiolo's come on board a few months ago, and he's looking at options for their iron ore project and for their platinum and lithium project as well. And it just seems that the vibe is just a lot more positive than it was before, hence the share price rise. What about you? Anything interesting you see?
That's an interesting see. I mean, even just a comment on the three stocks that we're on today, you know, I think Guardian's got the potential to be a pretty damn big company. I think, you know, if it continues to move the way it looks like it's going to and take over a big production amount of tungsten that originally has been imported from China, then I don't see anything but good things ahead. The raise at the same time as the news sort of, I think, took a bit of impetus from it. Otherwise, I think it would have been a bit higher. But I think that'll soon wash out because those people aren't for selling. You know, they're going to go in there. And then we had PR1, which looks very exciting for a market cap of like 6 or 7 million. Big contracts. Certainly the half space addition is going to mean much, much bigger revenues. And now they've got this PR1 bit, which is going to help small, medium-sized companies
actually do Bitcoin transactions themselves, which I think, again, is pretty exciting. There's lots of different avenues going on there. And then we've got Sovereign. I mean, I think Sovereign, as we said, even in the interview, it's a bit of a boring one. But ultimately, I think if you like 3, 4, 5 times your money, I think maybe boring is a good thing.
It's boring for now until Q4, and then it becomes exciting again. I mean, that's,
yeah.
But doing it properly is sometimes boring. That's just the way it goes. You just have to wait it out, and then it'll pop. I mean, that was another one that kind of they released their exploration news. So they're going for a massive exploration campaign across Greenland while they continue to optimize gold productions. So that's one to keep an eye on. Their share price is below the placing price, and they're fully funded to do everything they want to do now to a tune of tens of millions. And then I think, you know, more broadly, if we talk the gold price obviously rocketing ahead, copper price has gone absolutely ballistic. Just ballistic. It's almost at $6. So, you know, companies that we track and looking at, you know, producing copper or potentially selling copper assets, you've got Asia Met in, you know, in the data room at the moment. And again, really kind of boring, not really much going on, but when the news comes out, it should just rocket. We've got Bazant, which obviously has done really well and is going to continue to do well as we look, Colin continues to look at financing options.
And yeah, I think if that financing comes out with Bazant, I think it's going to be
ballistic. Yeah, we've done the numbers, haven't we? It's crazy. But the other one I think is possibly a really good, again, not advice, but a good buy, is African Pioneer, because again, they've got a license for a similar copper asset in the same country in Namibia. You know, similar management, similar everything. And yet, while Bazant has better financials behind it, by the Blackstone Minerals Capital, African Pioneer, what's the market cap even after the rise? Like £3 million?
No, less. Just over £2.5 million.
So, do you know, I mean, it's not throw your entire pension at it, but that's one where I think the upside potential is very strong as a speculative position. And you probably agree. Well, I know you will.
Yeah, I had the comparison that, yeah, it's close to 3 million actually now. I lied. At just over 1p, I think 1.07 or something's around the 3 million mark. But if Colin chose just to sell that license at Ongo, I think it's worth around 3 to 4 times the market cap if he doesn't do anything with it. And I think he's going to do stuff with it. That's without the licenses in Zambia, which are currently with First Quantum being investigated. And I think we're going to hear stuff about that in the coming months. And also the license in Botswana. So there is no possibility you can see that the assets are worth £3 million. It's just ridiculous. Because the license itself, in my view, is worth $12 to $15 million. So that's a £10 million, you know, cash payment if they chose to do it. So I think people just haven't quite grasped that, you know, it is silly at the minute. It has been silly, but that was on the basis that the license was definitely coming, and now the license has arrived. And therefore it's solidified, you know, it's so, yeah.
Well, and speaking of licenses, Energy Pathways, you've got to be getting close to that now. I mean, three tier one companies signing up to support Mesh in the space of a week. And I know we spoke to Ben a few days ago.
Yeah, we spoke to Ben, and you wrote that article, which I think is worth a plug. Have a read of it if you want to.
On the old Substack, on Twitter, just Google it, basically.
Yeah, understand some of those things.
But I think
again that the blue sky, something like Energy Pathways, is really quite high. It could be seriously worth a lot more money than it is now. Mm. Many factors. What's your take on all these coin plays then? Because basically it looks like they've all failed the flywheel test in the UK. But still, obviously, smart web companies flying high there with 1,800 bitcoins and, you know, a £2 valuation or a £2 value. But this is, 30% lower than the last time they raised? We saw Coin raise at 6p. And a few of the others have just seemed to have stopped. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this. I try not to comment too much on crypto stocks at the moment for reasons that will become apparent in the near future. But I think that in each jurisdiction with Bitcoin treasury plays, my view is there can only be one. This is the conclusion I've come to. And obviously in the US, it's a strategy, formerly MicroStrategy, Sailor's Baby. Japan, it's MetaPlanet. In the UK, I suspect there will be one because there's a demand to hold Bitcoin through tax advantage accounts like SIPs or ISAs. That one, I mean, at the moment, it looks most likely to be smarter web. That doesn't mean that'll hold true forever. But the problem that you have with the flywheel is that for the flywheel to work, you need to raise at higher prices each time. And the second you don't manage to do that, the writing is on the wall. So if the company, you know, I know smarter web have had to do that as well, which is a worrying thing if you're invested. But basically all of these companies, if you're buying Bitcoin, if you're raising capital at a lower price each time, that's, you know, that's when you're going to, the flywheel is going to go into reverse. Having said that, you know, this is kind of the start potentially of you know, a new potential sector in the UK. So we'll just watch with interest.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said, I think I said it 4 or 6 weeks ago when all this craziness was going on, that I really did think that the companies in the UK that would be successful would be companies that had both a good inherent business and Bitcoin treasury.
Yeah, underlying business.
And,
yeah.
And for me, I still think PR1 is going to be one of those. And the other one, I think, is Tiger Royalties. It's obviously much more complicated, but I really do think those two are going to do very well.
Well, Tiger is not a treasury company. I mean, it's invested in a treasury company, but that's one of many things that it does. So I think it got swept up in the treasury company euphoria. But what it's actually doing with the subnets with Tau is very different. So I think you can't really characterize it in the same, lump it in with everybody else, because it's doing different things. With priority, yeah. Yes. I mean, that Halfspace acquisition seems to, you know, been a good idea. Obviously, getting a couple of contracts, a large contract with a Premier League football club, if I'm not mistaken, a few days ago.
Yeah, £250,000.
Yeah, so do you know the
contract.
Really,
so if you imagine them getting 4 or 5 Premier League clubs, what would that
I think
do?
To basically, what you want to do, there's two things you want to do. The first is you want to be generating enough revenue, enough profit to cover all your working capital, so that, you know, you're not like risking dilution of shareholders. And you potentially you're close to there. That's the first thing. But the second thing is, once you have enough clients to create a snowball, it will snowball. You know, and it's not quite there yet, but when it gets there, then hopefully you'll find that it does very well. And then the third thing is, the company can't comment on it publicly, and we wouldn't ask them to, but the Primoris potential buyback of shares, that is still in play. Clearly, again, we haven't seen the original contract, so we can't say this with 100% certainty, but clearly, from like a layman's point of view, that lock-in was broken, and they're going to have to buy the shares back. And so when they do, you'd expect the share price to respond accordingly. Thoughts?
Yeah. No, I'm totally agreeing with you. If they do have to buy them back, which, you know, I think there's going to be legal stipulations based on what we understand at the minute. And in all honesty, even if this isn't any, or not even if it isn't, if it's any company, surely we've got to keep the integrity of this market in some way. And and they have basically stuck two fingers up about this. And it's nothing to do with the fact it's this company or that company. If you have this rule 7 or whatever, where basically you are tied in if there's any sort of deal, then you can't just flipping sell your shares. You can't do it.
Well, I think the basic thing is, you either have lock-in agreements as a rule as part of the IPO or, you know, or deal process, or you don't. And if you don't have them, that's fine. It's a level playing field. It'll be chaotic for the market, but everyone's on the same page. And if you do have them, then you can't sell. And, you know, I retain my shares, but we had a lock-in. I don't even know, was it towards the end of, at the end of June? We were, you know, most of us were locked in for.
Yeah, we were locked in and now we're not.
Well, no, I know. So I'm not like, I'll hold them because I want to hold them and make Primoris, you know, pay me for them basically at a much higher level. But it's we have this kind of crazy world where if AIM regulation do not enforce the regulation shouldn't exist. That's as simple as that.
Yeah.
That's our stance. Anyway.
So let's see where it all goes. Anyway, sporting things have happened since we last spoke. Mr. Scheffler walked away with the British Open in Royal Port Rush. I took it out of a stroll. And Liverpool are signing all the best players by the looks of things, so that's all good. And as we said, we weren't going to do any more roasts, but we lied. So hope you enjoyed this one. We'll be back maybe when we decide to do another one in the next 6 weeks before we start officially again.
So thanks for your time, Charles, and good luck. And make sure you press that subscribe button and get the notifications.
All the best. Cheers. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.